Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche. Auch bei den Johnsons. Oder, Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau. Made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil.
The axe of the blood god.
Welcome to another episode of Axe the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody. As I said on our primary podcast, I survived New York City.
Woo! Primary podcast. We're going to have to start a rivalry with the US Gamer podcast now.
I guess their flagship podcast is a better word, eh?
It's on, baby. So I will be leading the podcast again next week because Mike's going to be out for a review event. So I will be back on the US Gamer podcast next week. But otherwise, things are bad, Nadia. Times are bad.
Times are not very good. We were just talking about how you're having some connection problems because of the wildfires and everything.
Oh, God. Yeah. No, it's terrible. Thankfully, I live in the city, so I'm pretty much safe from the wildfires. But it's real bad up in Napa, Sonoma, Santa Rosa, that area. And I have multiple friends who have been impacted by this, who've had to evacuate. Their parents have had to evacuate. Shout out to my good friend, Vodka Tonic, who is a reader of the site and I believe a listener to the podcast. His mother had to evacuate. And my thoughts are with them, obviously.
Absolutely. Good luck.
Yeah, no, it's terrifying here because, I mean, you walk outside and the air is actually hazy.
Yeah. I was telling Katie how I follow John Davison's Facebook, and he does biking, and basically he has his big mask on now because you can't do anything otherwise. You can't breathe.
No, it's the worst. I haven't been able to go running, which, I mean, obviously that's a very small sacrifice, all things considered, but the air smells like campfire.
And it's been like that for a long time. Like, I remember you saying that, like, last week.
Yeah, no. So, and it's only going to get worse, apparently.
Wow.
So I'm just hoping that some of my friends' parents don't end up losing everything. But I bring it up in part not just to highlight the fact that it's a thing that's happening, but I also, you should go donate money. You can go and donate and help through the Red Cross. You should go. There's a city crowdfunding for Santa Rosa at the You Caring page that has raised more than $33,000 as of last week.
That's good.
And you should also look into the Sonoma County Resilience Fund that will be aiding mid to long term needs for displaced residents and the Airbnb's Open Homes program to host people who've had to evacuate. So you please go and help, and God, also donate to Puerto Rico, everything else. I mean, it's bad right now. So many disasters.
It's so sad how there's no shortage of things to donate to right now.
Yeah, I don't want to, like, make everybody sad. This isn't the podcast of talking about current events and disasters and politics. I understand that you guys are here for a little escape to listen to RPGs, but I kind of feel the need to be like, hey, guys, go help your fellow peoples. So
yeah, I think we're going to have to help each other out a lot in the coming days, months, years.
In the meantime, this is by no means nearly as bad as disasters in Northern California or in Puerto Rico or anything, but I'm real sad, Nadia. The U.S. men's soccer team got eliminated from the World Cup the other day, and I'm still recovering.
Yeah, I saw you were very sad about it on Twitter. You said it was a real waste of 4 years.
I mean, I've been grieving, and the worst thing is that I'm not going to be watching the next World Cup because it's basically the stadiums were built on slave labor.
Oh, where's that taking place?
Qatar.
Oh, geez, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's a corrupt World Cup built on slave labor, and it's an absolute atrocity, and I refuse to support it. And maybe not watching it, maybe a single person not watching won't help much, but at least I won't be finding myself in a position going, this World Cup sure is fun.
Yeah.
I'm just going to ignore now that these stadiums were built on the bones of migrant laborers.
Yeah, that sounds, at least you're putting your money where your mouth is. I mean,
yeah, that's all you can do, right?
Did that.
Now, if I just stop watching the NFL, like, my hands will be even cleaner. But as a result, I haven't been playing as many RPGs. I've actually been playing a lot of FIFA, which is kind of like an RPG.
It's kind of an RPG. Yeah, we've talked about that in the past.
I spend a lot of time grinding in that game for money.
Man, if only you could grind for money in real world.
Yeah, sports games, as I've said in the past, are basically RPGs. Very stats focused. A very collect 'em all type vibe. And this year's version has a thing called squad battles, which are basically daily challenges that are updated each day. It's kind of like an MMORPG in that regard. Basically, encouraging you to log in each day and play some games, collect some points. It's really annoyingly addictive, and I really need to stop.
That actually sounds a great deal like free-to-play mobile RPGs, where they want you to check in every single day, and they offer you like rewards for doing so.
Yeah, I'm kind of chuckling, to be honest, because everybody, of course, is up in arms about the whole loot box thing, and I suppose we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I mean, FIFA, EA's sports games have been doing the loot box thing for a while now. I mean, they're called... It's basically a CCG loot box thing where you buy a deck, where you get a pack of cards and you open it up and hope you may get one really good player, but mostly you'll probably get a bunch of trash.
A bunch of trash players.
Vendor trash that you have to kind of get rid of. Mm-hmm. And they totally balance the game toward spending money. And the entire culture is built around spending money. It's actually kind of insane. That's the thing that people miss about this whole loot box thing. Mm-hmm. Like, people are mad about it. But the fact of the matter is, there are going to be literally YouTube channels devoted to opening loot boxes.
There probably already is. You mentioned there are for sports games, right?
Yeah. No, there are people who spend all of their time just ripping packs. And this is the thing that goes back to Magic. Like, Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, that's true.
Where ripping packs is part of the culture for that.
Yeah.
And... I was listening to another podcast I was listening to. The host was talking about how his son has really gotten into baseball cards, but he doesn't really want the baseball cards. He just wants to watch YouTube channels of people opening packs of baseball cards.
Wow, when I was a kid, we just wanted the gum. That nasty-ass gum that cut your cheek.
But we talked a fair amount about the loot box thing on the flagship podcast earlier this week. I know that Mike and Katie... and you all had thoughts, but I just wanted to point out that this is a thing that goes back to RPGs, specifically free-to-play MMORPGs.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely.
And I'm constantly reminded of how back in 2010, I was playing Star Trek Online, and they had these frickin' lockboxes. I hated those lockboxes. Because they were even worse than regular loot boxes, because at least in the terms of loot boxing... Mm-hmm. You get a loot box for free every time you level up, right?
Right.
So you're periodically getting loot boxes, and if you don't want to spend money, you can hypothetically get away with not opening anything up.
Yeah.
But what's really annoying in this, in Star Trek Online, was that all of the drops were lock boxes, and the lock boxes, you had to spend $1 to buy a key to open the box.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
It was the worst.
It wasn't like you would level up, you get a box, you open it. Mm-hmm. You basically get a box and you had to buy the key.
Mm-hmm.
What a ripoff.
Total ripoff. And the worst feeling in the world was spending $1 to get a key and opening it up and getting like garbage. Just trash. And you go, wow. And they did their part to try and improve upon it. But what was really annoying is that they had special ships inside these lock boxes that you had to spend insane amounts and... You had like a 1 in a million chance. It was a ridiculously low chance of actually getting these ships. But some of them were so cool, and I didn't want them to be in the lockbox. I wanted them in my collection, damn it.
Yeah, of course. But if you want them, you have to pay and hope that you get them.
And what was really, really annoying was that a lot of these ships were super high-quality ships that people would bring into PvP and that kind of thing, and it would totally ruin the balance of the game. Now, that's pay to win.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole thing reminds me of, this wasn't a pay-to-win game because it was only single player, but one of the first times everyone lost their shit over a mobile game was Final Fantasy All the Bravest. Because if you wanted, basically the default players were like generic white mages, red mages, whatever. If you wanted the title characters like Cloud, whoever, you had to pay $1 and you'd get a random character. So, you know, I think Game Trailers put it like, you want Cloud? Fuck it, you get Shantotto. Who's that? From Final Fantasy XI. Dollar, gone.
It's the same with Fire Emblem Heroes.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you would spend to try and get these characters that you really wanted. All I wanted was the archer from Fire Emblem Fates. I think it was, it was from Birthright. He was on the Birthright side of the equation. One of the main character archers. He was so cool. I love the design. I desperately wanted him in my party, but I had like a 0% chance of getting him. At least in FIFA, there's an auction house.
Okay, yeah, that's true. That gives you a chance, a fighting chance.
Yeah, like if I scraped and scrimped and saved and played for months upon months, there's a non-zero chance that I could eventually have like a really great player like Messi or Ronaldo or Neymar on my team. These players cost literally hundreds of thousands of coins, even into the millions. But there's still a chance. At least I can buy them. I have no chance. I had no chance of getting that guy in Fire Emblem Heroes because I just wasn't willing to invest the money to keep going through the gachas. And even if I were, there was a pretty low chance that I would actually get him. Exactly. I hate that crap.
One thing I really hate about Fire Emblem Heroes gacha is that you can only draw, like the characters all are designated to a color like red, blue, green, or neutral. And every time you bring up the summoning altar, you can only summon, like you get a random, you kind of get random spots. So you might be able to summon like one red character and like three green characters or any number of combinations. So it wasn't even like you had a chance of getting like your favorite character, like a one, and even if it was like 1 in 1 million, fine. But you sometimes didn't even have that 1 in 1 million chance.
I know why companies do this. It's because
it's a crash cow.
There are whales out there who will spend literally thousands of dollars. I read with Star Trek Online, there are people who spent like $10,000 just opening lockbox after lockbox after lockbox looking for ships.
Where do people get this money? Give me some of this money. I want some of this money.
Well, I mean, there are some people who just, they don't have anything else to spend the money on.
Oh, it must be nice.
And they will tell you, well, don't tell me how to spend my money, which that's fine. You can spend your money any way you want. I don't understand it. I think it's completely insane that you're doing that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Even if you get the thing that you want, I don't know. I always feel a hollow pit in my stomach when I quote unquote monetize. Like, I spent $50 on Madden 18's Ultimate Team because I was like, well, this pack of cards is really, it's a pretty good value and I'm going to get a whole bunch of good players out of it. So it's probably worth spending the money on it.
Right.
But once I did, like, I got a whole bunch of good players and my team was kind of filled out a bit, but I had a hollow pit in my stomach of, why did I do that?
You did not feel fulfilled.
I did not feel fulfilled at all. So, but I totally blame the developers who are willing to turn a blind eye to the way that they are taking advantage of these people. They're going, well, you know, I'm not going to tell people how to spend your money. That's no better. I'm sorry. Maybe like there's a moral gap here, but it just reminds me of how back in the 2007, back in 2006, 2007, people were selling subprime mortgages and going, well, they should just do the research and understand what they're getting into. I don't see the, I don't see the moral problem here. It's bad all the way around.
That did not end well.
It's like casinos calling people who have gambling problems and telling them, hey, come back to the casino, yo. We got free drinks. And also we'll give you a credit. And we're giving you all this free stuff. Keep coming back. We want to take all your money.
I've never been to a Vegas casino, believe it or not. I did play slots in the Las Vegas airport and I had to stop over from E3 and I won $10. But my parents were telling me about these casinos because they visited. And they say, like, they have no clocks. They have no windows. There's no way to tell if time is passing. They just keep you fed and give, like, liquored up for dirt cheap, if not free prices.
Crazy. Vegas is the worst. I hate Vegas so much. I
want to visit. Just
Have you never been to Vegas?
No, other than that airport stopover, no.
It's you feel like you're in bizarro world,
mm-hmm.
because everything is super quote-unquote high class, but also astonishingly tacky.
Sounds like my kind of place.
And you're walking through, you're in these labyrinthian malls. Everything is just labyrinthian mm-hmm. shopping malls beyond the casinos. And then as you're walking past the buffets, it's just a line a mile long of people riding scooters, obese people in scooters heading into the buffet. And you're like, yep, these are the kind of people who are coming to Vegas to spend their weekend.
Like, kind of like, what was that movie? Wall-E? And they're all just kind of riding
yeah,
around in
no.
the pushy chairs?
That's what it goes. And yes, there are people who, regular people who go to Vegas and enjoy it. And I'm not going to begrudge you. I'm just saying that when I was there, ugh.
It's, weird place.
It's just so tacky. Everything about it is so amazingly tacky. But yeah, I think the thing that I really begrudge about loot boxes is I've said this, I ranted about this on the podcast before. I ranted about it with Fire Emblem Heroes. I really hate it when it skews the balance of the game, when it is encouraging grinding. And Middle Earth Shadow of War is only in the most tertiary of sense a RPG.
Right.
Yeah, it has loot, whatever. But the fact that these loot boxes are coming in order to get the best ending, you have to grind orcs. And it's like, well, you can either grind for orcs or you can spend money on loot boxes. What you want to do?
Yeah, that's just so against the spirit of Lord of the Rings and Tolkien and everything. It's just, there was someone who said on Twitter, hey kids, why don't you check out, like, learn about the real loot box, your local library.
So the best ending traditionally has been either there's an Easter egg, like some kind of specialized piece of knowledge that you mm-hmm. can use to get to the best ending, or you have some like really amazing skill. A great example is Valkyrie Profile, which I brought up before. Yeah, you have to use a guide essentially to get the best ending, but it's really gratifying to have that piece of knowledge, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There's not grinding per se involved at all. It's just knowing what you need to do to trigger the best ending. That's an Easter egg. It's neat. I like it.
Right.
To just put it behind, to just balance it around grinding.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, it's just a time sink. Either you pay to accelerate or you grind, and we know and we are balancing it explicitly so you spend money. I don't like that. I think that compromises the game.
I agree. And I feel really bad for the developers working on this game because it's not their decision as far as I know.
No.
Usually it's not. It's the publisher saying, hey, you know what? Make us some real good money here.
And
it's
only going to get worse because publishers are finally waking up to the fact that, holy crap, Overwatch and Madden and FIFA make ungodly amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're going to keep making these platforms, oh, don't forget GTA 5. GTA 5, I think at this point, Rockstar could buy their own country.
they probably
have a measurable GDP.
Rockstarsia.
The amount of money that GTA 5 generates from all of their online stuff. They're finally wake up to the fact that, hey, loot boxes are worth a lot of money. And this is it. This is our future right here.
Something we talked about on the podcast yesterday is, yes, people love loot boxes. They buy them. Overwatch is an excellent example. But given, like Mike brought up, how there's been one game after another in this instance with like really scummy loot boxes, like, including Shadow of War. And there's been a lot of backlash against scummy loot boxes like this. Now, will publishers step back a little bit and say, okay, you know what? Cosmetic stuff, fine. We can like farm that out till the cows come home. We can make $1 million off that because you can. Overwatch is all cosmetic. So are they going to kind of cease with this whole pay-to-win thing, at least for a while, kind of step back a little bit? Or are they going to go full bore? I'm eager to see or to know how many loot boxes people have bought in Shadow of War, for example.
Oh, they're going to go full bore because the gaming community is up in arms, but the average person doesn't care.
That's a good point too, yeah.
They're so inured to this pricing structure, to this way of making money through mobile gaming and everything, that they're like, yeah, no, this is perfectly normal. I'm just going to spend for my gacha boxes, whatever. Like, I'm used to this. Mm-hmm. And I don't think developers care at all.
Well, then again, it's been this way for a very long time in Asia, a lot of mm-hmm. parts of Asia.
That's why it was like free-to-play MMORPGs. That's where it kind of originated, yeah.
Yeah. And one of the first, the first instance I ever saw of paying for free to play stuff is I used to play this kind of this Worms clone called Gunbound on on a web browser. It was like 2004. And one day they were like, hey, you could buy these custom accessories for actual money. I'm like, what the hell is this noise about? And here we are.
This
is a Korean a game based in Korea.
I remember thinking once upon a time that free-to-play MMORPGs were a good idea. How wrong I was. They ruined everything.
Having reviewed many, many of them, although it's been a long time since I've really dedicated myself to mobile reviews, there were definitely some of them that were well-balanced and they were pretty fair, and they still gave you a good incentive to buy loot boxes. And then there are the ones that were just scum. So I guess maybe there's still that balance out there. I don't know. I haven't checked in on a while.
I doubt that there's that balance, but all right. I said my piece about loot boxes. I hate them. And I was playing Battlefront, and it actually completely blows my mind. Of course EA did this, because they made so much money off Ultimate Team. That's where their mindset is. Of course they made it where you got actual gameplay items out of their loot boxes. It's so stupid. How can they compromise the gameplay to that extent? It's unbelievable.
That's what they're doing.
All right. Moving on to something that's also kind of unbelievable. EZ8's localization is being redone by NIS America.
Yeah, I am surprised on this one.
This is completely insane on so many levels. Okay, we can never... let me just say, please don't ever complain about Treehouse's localization or Alice's localization ever freaking again. Okay? Yeah. To screw up the localization to the point where you have to put out a make good patch, where you have to actively fix it, that is insane.
But I'm still confused because, okay, I haven't finished the game. It's definitely a game that I want to finish because I really enjoyed it. But I did not have a big problem at all with the localization. And as I've said in our flagship podcast yesterday, I am not like hardcore EZ fan. But I am familiar with the more modern ones. Like I played Ark and I played Oath and Fel'Ghana. So I did not find it to be a step down. I don't get where people are coming from.
I mean, it's grammatical issues, typos, Kotaku had a pretty great example. They highlighted an example. So in the original Japanese, it was crevice of the Archaeozoic era. And the EZ8 localization is Archaeozoic big hole.
Okay, I didn't notice too much of that. Stuff like that, absolutely fix that. But again, I don't think it was so much of a problem that I noticed it a lot. And one thing Mike said yesterday that makes a lot of sense is this is an era where people can take a screenshot, present it out of context to social media and say, look what a bad job this is. Look how horrible this is. And people say, oh yeah, that's awful. And then the person says, this is what it said in the original Japanese. And everyone's like, oh yeah, you're right, I understand. So not much has changed, I guess. Like, look how much people dumped on Woolsey back in the day.
I like this one. Yeah, I ate and took a shit. I'm feeling great today as usual.
That's the one screenshot that confuses me. That's Sahad. He talks like that throughout the whole game. He doesn't really get rough as the word shit. He kind of alludes to other bodily functions, but that is the way he talks. He is that tropey Japanese big, you know, guy, heart of gold, like, you know, says what comes to mind sort of thing. Like, it's perfectly in character for him from what I saw of him.
That big hole might be a good location for Dana.
Okay, that's great.
Oh.
It's not like the most brilliant localization, I guess, but again, I didn't notice a huge gap between that and the other EZ games. I still think it's great that they're going back, they care that much to go back and fix it. That's really good of them. I just don't think it was like, we're not talking about like something that's so horrible. I was distracted from playing the game.
Well, NIS America doesn't have a great reputation for their localization. And a lot of that is due to the fact that they're kind of a smaller publisher.
Yeah.
And they are of limited resources. But the fact of the matter is localization actually is important. And
oh, yeah.
people do pay attention to localization issues, and the fact that they apparently messed it up this badly is actually really bad, because they're having to go back and getting a new editor and a new translator to take a look at this. I'm sure it costs them a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, that's why I really admire them for doing it, because that goes to show how much they do care about the fans, because they could have told them to go hang, but they didn't. They are putting, obviously, a lot of effort into redoing this.
Yeah, apparently there was a petition going from fans to actually get this fixed, but fans were concerned going in, because XSEED has a relatively solid reputation for putting together good localizations.
Right.
And they and fans are going, I don't know, NAS America, I'm not sure. I really hope that this works out. And it seemingly hasn't. Because NAS America, this is the first Ease game that NAS America has done.
Right, right. Okay.
So they've kind of had their chance, and now they've really blown it.
Well, I'm glad that they're going to try to make it right by the fans. I mean, again, I didn't have a big problem with the translation, but I am not like a really hardcore Ease fan. And I can see how people who have been following this game since it was in Japan and kind of having fans translate it as they go, I guess I can see why they would be irritated that the translation did not meet up to their expectations.
People have very high standards for localization, but I think that in the case of Ease 8, it's like, I think it's self-evidently bad. And people were highlighting the fact that some of NIS America's past localization problems, like they did, this is a game I haven't thought about in years, but Artanelica 2.
Oh, geez, that's a name I haven't heard in ages.
Yeah, which apparently actually had a bug from their localization that ended up locking up the game.
Oh, beautiful. I love it when that happens.
When you're fighting a certain boss, it would lock up the game.
Oh my god. It's like Suikoden 2, how there were patches where they just forgot to translate into English outright.
Yeah, there are some of their games. There are some of their games where you just ran into untranslated text.
That was great.
Yeah, my gosh.
I'm so sad when I think about that.
But they are setting a deadline of the end of November.
Wow. It's
a pretty aggressive timeline to go back and fix a bad localization. And they're going to put it, and the PC version will be launching with this localization.
Right. So that could be why they delayed it in the first place, because they, maybe there was a backlash came in really quickly and they said, oh, well, this is a problem. We better fix this. So yeah, good on them.
Here's the thing that a bunch of people are wondering. They are wondering if they should hold off on playing Ease 8 because they're going, well, should I be playing this? Should I be waiting for a real localization? Because am I not getting the proper story? Should I be waiting for the patch? What do you think, Nadia?
Again, there was nothing there that distracted me from the game, which I really enjoyed. But if you are a big Ease fan, and if you have been following this game, as I said, since its Japanese inception, I guess I could understand why you might want to wait until they fix out the translation. But I will say, make sure you do get it, because it is a really good game. I think our friend Anthony was saying how it was better than Breath of the Wild. I don't know if I agree with that.
Lol. Come on, Anthony. I know that Polygon was praising it to the moon. They really liked it.
Yeah, I think it was Phil Kohler who reviewed it. And yeah, I didn't get to do a full review, but I did do impressions, and I really enjoyed it. And I am looking forward to going back to it. But again, I guess I'll wait until they fix it. May as well at this point.
It reminds me of last year when they announced that Final Fantasy 13 was getting an addendum to the infamous Chapter 13. Did I say Final Fantasy 15?
Okay, I was going to say,
Was it getting an addendum to the infamous Chapter 13? And people were going, they're changing the story. They're adding an update to the story. What the heck? Like, this isn't the definitive version. I'm not going to play it.
Yeah, I remember that.
And now they're changing the localization.
Yeah, I would say if you just want a really good action game, because Ease isn't a series that you have to play from game to game. It's very easy to jump into anytime you want. If you just want a really good action game, like you're really hankering for one right now, by all means, grab it now. If you really are that interested in the story, I guess I would wait.
As far back as June, people were already wondering about the localization, by the way. So somebody was pointing out that there was an item called the merciless shivering vase. And they were going, oh, what the heck? This kanji does not mean vase, right? Like, these kinds of details do matter when it comes to developing a game.
The one thing I can think of off the top of my head is you start the game off in a place called the Nameless Coast, and in the Japanese text it's called like the Sunshine Coast, and it's like that's a bit of a kind of a weird mistranslation there.
Yeah, it is a weird.
Why would something sun-soaked be associated with the term nameless? That is weird. And it is not totally incorrect because it is a nameless area. Well, not really nameless, but it's a very mysterious area. So I guess I could see how a nice buff out would be good for the script.
Indeed. Well, we'll see how this ends up going, and we'll see if they're able to keep their self-imposed deadline, their very aggressive deadline of...
Yeah.
I mean, they're even recording new voiceover lines, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what they said.
The voice acting in that game is pretty middle of the road, not bad. I did notice one error, though, where, like, you can fish in the game, and whenever Adol casts his line into the water, sometimes he says, oh, shoot, like he missed, you know what I mean? Like, he didn't bring up a fish. But I'm casting, you know, I haven't brought up a fish yet. You don't have to swear at me.
All right. Nadia, it's time for a new report.
I've heard the rumors. We're going to start finally, huh?
We're starting a new report in addition to the Final Fantasy IX report, and that is the Secret of Mana report, the Secret of Mana report, I don't know, whatever.
What
yes.
Do you like?
Yes, Nadia, I am keeping my promise. I have officially started playing Secret of Mana now that it is out on the SNES Classic. I kicked it off last weekend with my girlfriend, and this is how it went. Well, we sat down and we're like, yeah, we're going to play this together. But I discovered, of course, the co-op is not immediately in there. You have to wait a little bit.
Right. It takes a little bit to meet up with another party member.
Yes. So the way it goes is you're in a village and you're playing over a waterfall or something like that with your friends, who are kind of jerks, by the way.
Oh, yeah, they're dicks.
Totally abandoning you like that? Jeez.
Oh, he's hurt bad. Let's get out of here.
Yes. And you end up falling into a sacred area that you're not allowed to go into, mm-hmm. and you find a rusty sword. Mm-hmm. And because why not? Because you need to cut through and get out, you end up taking it. Yep. Though it seems that the sword summons you.
Yeah, the sword summons you, and apparently you're not supposed to be able to pull it out. It's supposed to be pulled out by, quote-unquote, a knight in times of great trouble, which something's really screwed up if you're the one who did that.
And it's actually a fairly quick introduction.
Very much so,
yeah, you get your sword within like the first 5 minutes of the game. You go to the village. They're like, we cast thee out.
Get the hell out of here.
But don't you fight? I think you fight a boss first.
You
fight a boss almost immediately.
Yeah, basically, as I recall, the village, they say, is being protected by the sword. And now that you've pulled it out, you've attracted all these monsters to the area. And in fact, when you enter like one of the first stages of the game, you see this little rabbit, which is a little rabbit with like teeth. And you're like, whoa, what's a rabbi doing here? And you start basically hacking up these enemies as you make your way back to the village. And by the time you get there, it's attracted the mantis ant, which is the first boss you fight.
Yeah, I felt real bad when I started killing the local wildlife. I was like, well, that doesn't seem like a great use of your sword.
They're awfully cute, aren't they? But I think Seiken Densetsu 3 has the black rabbi, which will just destroy you. So don't feel too bad.
All right, I won't. It reminds me a bit of Pokemon, where I just feel like I'm leaving a trail of Rattata corpses.
They just faint. It's okay.
No, they're dead. When they get hit by a hyper beam from a Dragonite, there's nothing left of that Rattata. It is a pile of ash and bones.
Well, if you didn't kill it, then some Pidgey would. I mean, Pokemon is not shy about insinuating that the Pokemon eat each other.
It's the circle of life.
It's brutal, man.
But so you end up meeting with a kind of a wise old man, and he says that you need to go to something called Gaia's Navel. Mm-hmm. Not entirely certain what that is.
It's basically a region of the map The thing about Secret of Mana, now thinking back to it, it's not very good about telling you where to go next.
No. He says, go south. And I'm like, yeah, all right, I'll go south. And you're kind of in an overworld, but not really in an overworld. Yeah. And it's almost like an outdoor dungeon, I suppose.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It really is. Because before you can get to Gaia's navel, you have to go through the Kingdom of Pandora, which is a kingdom where most people are zombies and they won't talk to you, and there's not a lot you can do there at that point. And then you hang a left, I think, and you exit from the left and you keep on going and you'll be at Gaia's navel.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I did. I went south down to Pandora. I met all the zombie people who were like dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And I went into the castle and a girl comes running out and I'm like, aha, there's my companion. And I was like to Emily, all right, there's your character. We have to figure out how to go get her. I continued on to Gaia's navel, assuming that I would get her.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually fought a whole bunch of stuff in Gaia's navel. And then I got a little confused and wasn't sure where to go. And so I decided to look up a walkthrough. And it was like, no, 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 go to the haunted forest.
Yeah.
And then you'll find her. And I was like, oh, I went to the wrong place because there's a split.
Yeah.
You can kind of go west to the Haunted Forest, or you can keep going south to the Gaia's navel.
Yeah.
So I went to the wrong place. So I went up to the Haunted Forest, and I run into these two werewolves who immediately kick the shit out of me.
Oh, yeah. They're brutal. See, here's the thing that I usually do, and this is, I never even thought of doing it your way, so I'm learning new things. I go through Gaia's navel, I meet the dwarves, and that's where you recruit the sprite.
Yes.
So, and then you fight one of the bosses there, and you can get an orb to make your sword stronger when you forge it. So, yeah.
So,
and then I go to the forest.
So I didn't do any of that. I went to the forest first. I went up to the forest.
Destroyed.
I actually, the first time, you're fighting these two werewolves who just appear, and they're very fast, and if they hit you, they're going to hit you a whole bunch more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're kind of screwed.
Yeah.
Because you're going to end up losing a ton of health. You could end up even losing all of your health, essentially.
Yeah. And they heal. They can heal themselves for.
Yeah. They can also heal themselves and they can flank you. So you have to keep moving around and you have to be very conservative about the way that you attack. And by the way, if you didn't realize, Secret of Mana is an action RPG. It's not a turn-based RPG, so you have to use your skills and reflexes to win this fight.
Yeah, and it's kind of special in that you can't just hack away at the enemy. You have to, like, take a swing, wait till you're at 100% power, take another swing, 100% power.
Yes, that's the way that the battle system works. I don't know how I feel about the pacing in that.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the battles feel a little slow.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, but once you have companions, it becomes a little easier, but yeah, it's not like Zelda, which is like hack, 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 hack.
No. I suppose that the downside of being able to just be like hack, hack, hack is that it's a little repetitive and it requires a little more communication and tactics to communicate with your partner and be like, okay, now you go in. Okay, I'll go in. Now you go in, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're just like kind of slashing at nothing.
Exactly.
And I find it interesting that even if you don't do any damage, a swipe of your sword, even at low power, will stun an enemy, which is a useful thing.
Them. Yeah.
So, but yeah, I killed the werewolves, and Prim came into my party. Emily took control of Prim. So now we're together. We keep running into this cat.
Oh, that's Nico.
Who's selling stuff along the way. So I've been buying
prices.
Gear. It took me a while to realize how I was supposed to be equipping armor.
I guess the ring menu system is a little confusing in this day and age.
Yeah, it's pretty confusing because you go into equip armor and you see accessories, but you don't see any of the other armor. And what you don't realize is that you're supposed to press up on the controller. And once I figured that out, I was like, oh, okay, maybe it would have helped if I had equipped the superior armor that I ended up buying.
Yeah, it usually helps a bit.
Because I was confused because I bought the armor and then it wasn't showing up the menu and then I assumed that it was for the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, I must have accidentally bought an item for the sprite.
Yeah.
But no, that wasn't the case. But then I was like, no, no, but my character can totally wear this. I see his little hat. I see his little head.
Yeah. That's cute.
So what I eventually figured out, we updated everything. I'm using the sword. Emily's using the spear. Mm-hmm. I went back to Gaia's navel. I found the dwarves, which has the most repetitive soundtrack.
Isn't that the awfulest music in the history of everything? I don't understand what is with that music to this day.
It's so bad that I had to mute it. I turned the volume of the TV all the way down because it was like a dentist drill in my head.
It's so awful. Such a beautiful soundtrack most of the time, and then it's got it's just
oh no, God, no, yeah, you're doing it to me. Oh jeez, ah, you're giving
that's
me terrible
kind of
memories.
Music that makes your parents say turn that off and do your homework.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how annoying that kind of music must be for parents who are, I mean, when we were all growing up, we would be playing these games going, man, what great soundtracks. And to them, it must have been just the most repetitive crap.
My best friend's father called it computer-generated noise.
I mean, it's kind of what it is, right? It's meant to be background noise that keeps you focused on the game. Like, that's meant to add to the game without distracting from it.
Although my parents did really appreciate Final Fantasy VI's soundtrack back then.
I mean, who couldn't? It was an amazing soundtrack.
It was pretty great.
I had a friend, by the way, who he had a Super Nintendo, and I would go over. And at the time, I didn't really realize it, but he was a bit of a brat. And he would be like, now sit down and listen to this music. And so I'd sit down and he would crank it up to the absolute like ear splitting volumes. And his mom would be like, oh my God, turn that music down. He'd be like, shut up, mom.
Oh my God. I'd be destroyed if I said that to my mom. I wouldn't exist anymore.
Yeah, well, I don't think he came to. So that kid didn't have a great life to my knowledge, but in any case, yeah, so screw him. But that was the most annoying, most repetitive music I've ever heard.
Yeah.
So what were we going to say?
Oh, I was going to say the rest of the game's music is fantastic and some really experimental soundtracks on
there.
Yeah,
it's decent. It's all right. I haven't heard a lot that's like really stood out to me, but it's pretty solid SNES music.
Yeah, I think a lot of it will stick out to you later on. It's really the kind of music that doesn't hit you so much at first, but then you kind of remember it. And you're like, oh, you know, that's a really nice soundtrack.
Tough act to follow after playing Chrono Trigger, must be said.
That is true. I can understand that.
But of course, Chrono Trigger came out a couple of years later. Yeah. And I mean, it only has some of the greatest developers ever working on it. So, yeah. I mean, what are you going to do? But I went to the dwarf guy with everything that I needed, upgraded the sword, I think it is, and I've got the sword, she's got the spear, I got the sprite. That little jerk of a sprite took my money.
That was great.
Such a little carn artist.
Yeah, a little, they have like the whole carny thing going on where it's like, see the rare rabbite man, and it's like they give you one rabbite and one man and say, it's a rabbite man. And then they don't understand why you're upset.
And they're like giving me a whole sob story about why this sprite is there and has to work off this insane debt. And I'm sitting here going, oh man, am I going to have to pay this insane debt to be able to get this sprite onto my team?
I'll pay it.
But nope. Nope, I did not have to do that. The sprite ended up joining my party in relatively short order. Mm-hmm. What's a good weapon for the sprite?
You know, I usually stick him with a boomerang.
Oh yeah, okay. So he has a boomerang already. Like, that's his default.
Yeah, it's a good weapon because it cuts through a bunch of enemies at once. That's a good weapon. The spear's a good weapon, and the sword's a good weapon. And I really like the whip, too, but you don't have that yet.
I'm a little confused as to how I'm supposed to give the sprite directions, because it doesn't seem as if they're appearing on that little grid where you can set them to giving attack or defend or whatever.
Really? That's interesting. Like, you go to the action grid, and he's not there?
Not yet, but maybe soon?
Have you fought with him? Like, has he officially
not yet
joined your? Okay, so he will.
I mean, because I've been playing with a partner,
right?
Maybe I was just thinking that maybe it would take a little bit for, maybe that's why it wasn't appearing right away, because she was controlling, the Prim. So
yeah,
it's such a shame, by the way, and we've said this before, but it's such a shame that there's no multi-tap for the SNES Classic.
I know. I wonder if it would work, like if there's a way to make it. No, I guess not. You can't plug in the multi-tap.
Yes. So, yeah, that's pretty much where we ended. They opened the shortcut to the witch's castle, because apparently the witch was a good lady once, but she has been turning people into zombies, and that's not
cool. Yeah, she's a jerk now, so you have to do something about that.
Yes, so I'm going to have to go and do that, and Prim is going to go and try and save her boyfriend.
Diluc,
yes. Yeah. So, initial impressions so far. The battle system is interesting. It's a little slow-paced because obviously you have to do the gauge, wait for the gauge to get to 100% to do a decent amount of damage, and you have to coordinate with your partner where you're like, I go in and hit, she goes in and hit, I go in and hit. There's some pretty annoying enemies, like the bees.
Oh, screw the bees, man.
The bees that come in and sting you and you're poisoned.
Yep.
That's pretty annoying, but you have candy, and that will heal yours, and I'm like, candy. Give me the candy. More sugar, please.
And as you level up, you will find that you can evade enemies' attacks much easier, especially lower enemies.
Yes, I noticed that, because I ran into some slimes who were avoiding my attacks a whole bunch, and it was super annoying.
Those are good things to level up on, though.
It was that wonderful RPG conceit of, yes, this is an action game, but because of unseen stats, sometimes you're going to miss, despite the fact that you actually hit them. So yeah, your sword will go right through them. I hate that.
There's a lot of that going on in Secret of Mana, so buckle up.
The absolute worst was in Mass Effect, where you would be pretty clearly aiming your gun right at a bad guy, but there was a built-in evasion counter, and you would sometimes just miss anyway.
I think Casey Green did a comic like that concerning Fallout, where you're using the VAT system, and it says like you have a 90% chance of hitting this super mutant's head, 10% chance of missing. And like that one 10% chance, when it happens, the bullet just veers off into the sky for no reason whatsoever.
Yes. Same with XCOM. You're like point blank range, and it's like 99% chance of hitting. And then you somehow go, pew! Like just right over their shoulder, and you're just like, really? Really? XCOM drives me crazy with that kind of crap.
You sneeze. True.
So I've been enjoying it for the most part. It's different, if nothing else. And I look forward to seeing some more Secret of Mana. But that is the Secret of Mana report number one. And by the way, by the time this podcast is up, there should be a written version of the Secret of Mana report on the website. Nadi also did a written version of this Final Fantasy IX report. So you should go check them out.
Yeah, okay. And my second part should be up by the time this podcast is out. So, yay.
Excellent. All right, Nadia, Final Fantasy report number 4, is it, at this point?
I think we're at 4. The written part, I am at 2. So it's a little bit confusing, but we'll get through this.
Yes, we will. It turns out you're pretty busy with other stuff, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm reviewing the South Park RPG, so kind of have to do that.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that next week, along with Etrian Odyssey 5. But
oh, that should be cool.
Yeah.
But here's where I am. Basically, last time I left off, I believe I was in Lindbloom talking to Regent Cid and saying, Garnet's mother's gone crazy. Please help us. So she's still crazy. And we got a message from Bermesia, a.k.a. the City of Rats, saying the Queen's
Rat
wiped
town.
Out.
Rat town. Town of Rats.
The City of Rats. Saying the Queen's wiped out our kingdom. Please come help us. So I have Freya in my party by now, and she's like, well, of course I'm going. And Zidane says that I'm going to. And I actually recruited
Quina.
Quina. I recruited Quina.
I think it's Quina, right? Yeah.
It's either Quina or Quina, but I recruited her. She's my blue mage who eats people and to learn their powers instead of just getting hit by their attacks, which is pretty funny. So she's going to. And Garnet says, I'm going too. And of course, Zidane says, no, you're not. You're you know, you're princess. You're too soft. You can't go. So Garnet drugs everyone. And when they're all asleep, she's like, well, I'm going to go talk to my mom, because obviously this is all a big misunderstanding. So she heads back towards the kingdom. And from there, the plot splits between playing with her and playing as Zidane, who goes to Bermesia with Freya and Quina. So I've been kind of juggling both plot lines, and where I am now is I visited Bermesia, and yep, it is totaled. I met Kuja, who is, I'm guessing, the big bad in the game. He's allied himself with the Queen of Alexandria, who's still nuts, and the Lady Knight. I'm trying to remember her name.
Beatrix.
Beatrix, yeah. She's pretty cool.
Beatrix Kiddo. Oh, no, wait.
Kiddo? What? Hey, Kiddo.
Have you ever seen Kill Bill?
No, I haven't. You know what? I haven't.
You would like Kill Bill.
I probably would. I'm meaning to see it.
If you're a weeaboo, then you're going to definitely like Kill Bill. It's like watching a JRPG in live-action movie form.
Yeah, basically, I've heard of that. Kind of like The Fifth Element, which is very much the same thing.
Somebody asked on Twitter, what are the five movies that you would tell a significant other to watch to get a feel for who you are? Mm-hmm. And Kill Bill was definitely on that list for me. But
oh, I think I chose Airplane, South Park, Princess Mononoke, and Best in Show, which is a great movie, more people need to watch.
Great
Have
movie.
You seen that? Isn't
yes,
it great?
I love that movie. Oh my god!
Being a former
the lesbian,
dog
lover, the lesbian it. With the little dog is my absolute favorite character. But
oh, we got to have a podcast about that one day.
Yes, after we'll wrap up the RPG podcast and we'll do a Best in Show breakdown in the show. Podcast. The Best That's in Show awesome. Report coming up soon.
Yes, I am all about this.
Followed by the Kill Bill report.
Nadia's Kill Bill report.
But yes, so you've met a number of fairly important characters now. But let's start with the most important character of all, Quinna.
Quinna, yeah.
What do you think?
The most important character. She's pretty great, and she's really useful in battle because she is, as I said, a blue mage. But to get powers, you have to eat enemies, which is a little tricky because you have to get them down to, I think, 25% health. Otherwise, she can't eat them. And of course, they have to have a skill that's useful. Otherwise, she'll just say, oh, this tastes bad, and she won't learn anything.
Beats hanging out in the veldt.
What's that?
Beats hanging out in the veldt in Final Fantasy VI.
That's true. It does. Especially since I cheat a little bit and kind of look up who has skills and who doesn't. Because, you know, I don't really have time to pick through this.
Are you using Quinna?
Yeah, so far I haven't really had a chance to switch out characters. Like, everyone's split off. Like, Garnet's with... Shoot, what's the poor tin man's name? I'm totally forgetting his name now.
Steiner,
yeah.
Yeah, Steiner's off on his own right now.
Yeah, she's with Steiner, and I actually met up with Zidane's old band, and we retrieved something called Super Soft to save, I think, Blank, which is his name, because he got petrified in the haunted forest.
Yes.
Yeah, so we're in the middle of doing that, and I actually returned to the castle to talk to the queen, and I'm captured by Zorn and Thorne. And that's
yes,
for her.
I do not like those characters. They're like
jerks.
Jesters.
They're evil demon jester things. So I'm captured, and that's where her story has ended. So basically right now, where I am right now is Bermesia has been destroyed, so I fled to with the refugees and met them at that big town that's in a tree, which is really cool. I like tree towns.
The end of Disc 1. So it
Was
used to be
end
a
of
thing.
Disc 1?
Yeah, that's the end of Disc 1. That
really?
Used to be like a key marker in PlayStation RPGs, the end of a disc.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
All right, here's a question for you. Which Final Fantasy has the best end of Disc 1, in your opinion? Because, let's see, Final Fantasy VII's... How does Final Fantasy VII's first
Seventh
disc
end? Like, right when Aerith gets killed, basically. And that's actually my favorite, because it's a very...
Wow, that very, they put that much on the first disc?
They did. That's why I was surprised to hear you say, oh, it's the end of disc one. Like, what? Because disc two had maybe half that content.
That's the back of the game, and the third disc is just the final dungeon.
Just Sephiroth, yeah. Disc one was definitely my favorite in Final Fantasy VII, because it was just a very melancholy ending. I love the City of Ancients. I love the music. I love the atmosphere. It's just so creepy. Aerith is dead, of course, and Cloud is...
Hell of a way to end the disc.
Cloud says to his friends, look, I don't know who I am, but I want to find out. And if you want to come with me, then you're welcome to. We're going to go chase Sephiroth. And that was just a great way to end that disc.
Final Fantasy VIII. Final Fantasy VIII's first disc also ends on a really strong note. It's one of my absolute favorite sequences, which is the attempted assassination on Sorceress Ultimisia. Not Ultimisia, Sorceress Adele?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was Adele first.
Adele. the pop artist, but... or was it
we don't
Eden?
Like your songs anymore.
Sorceress Eden?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember. The sorceress. One of the sorceresses.
The sorceress before Ultimisia.
Yes, her. You're putting together an entire assassination plot, and it's cutting to different characters as you're getting yourself into position. And then you get that really kick-ass cutscene where Squall jumps down after your sniper totally like gets cold feet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you have to talk him into shooting her. But then, of course, he shoots and she deflects it with her shield. And Squall goes, jumps down, jumps into a car, drives up to her parade float, jumps up. But, oh, wait, there's Cypher waiting for you. It's on, baby. And then you have a really anticlimactic battle where you like totally take him out. Because if you have been doing it right, you're probably doing well in excess of like 2,000 damage at this point, and you're probably going to kill him in two hits.
That's Final Fantasy VIII.
That's Final Fantasy VIII for you. So, but
I kind of miss.
Oh, and you die. You die at the end of disc one.
Oh, that's right. And Squall stays dead, according to fan theory, which isn't true. I wrote about that.
The fan theory. Every fan theory is, but they're actually dead.
Yeah, of course it is. They're actually dead.
In fairness, though, that disc is pretty ambiguous because he totally gets a whole bunch of, ice spears through his shoulder and then falls off a very long way. That guy should be dead.
Yeah, okay? Absolutely.
And then from that point on, he's in purgatory, as evidenced in the desert prison and blah, 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 whatever. And time compression is him going to hell. I don't know.
There's a whole, like, I love how basically they were told, look, you're thinking about this too much in that feature I wrote.
But in Final Fantasy IX, the Final Fantasy IX's disc ends with the destruction of Bermesia with the Black Mage army coming on in. And you see the big bad of the game, Kuja.
Who just kind of has Queen's We Will Rock You as his theme song. Why the hell not?
So when I saw Kuja, did you see Kuja when you played Final Fantasy IX originally?
No, I did not. But I did know him vaguely from Dissidia.
Okay. Kuja was a big moment the first time I saw him in Final Fantasy IX. Because, of course, everybody loves Sephiroth.
Yeah.
Sephiroth was awesome. We all loved Sephiroth. And then in Final Fantasy VIII, the villain was a little more ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
You had Ultimisia. It was like time compression and all that stuff. And maybe she wasn't as strong a villain as Sephiroth. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going, Sephiroth and Kefka, two of the greatest villains of all time. I want the long silver hair. I want the big cool sword, the whole nine yards. And so Square was kind of like, whatever, fine. Here, have your silver-haired pretty boy as your villain. It's Kuja. And he's ambiguously gay, and he also has a big pet dragon. Are you happy?
He does have that really cool dragon. I did get to see the dragon, and it looked pretty awesome.
Yeah, it does look pretty awesome, doesn't it?
Actually, it reminds me of a mana beast from Secret of Mana, but you'll see that soon enough.
Pretty solid entrance. And then meanwhile, Beatrix is a great example of the unwinnable battle. What do you think of unwinnable battles, Nadia?
They confuse me, because sometimes when I'm getting my ass walloped in a game, I'm like, oh, it's okay, this is scripted. Then it says game over, and I'm like, oh, fuck. So,
it's the worst feeling in the world when you're getting
really
completely your ass completely owned, and you're going, yeah, no, this is totally unwinnable, game over. Oh, crap.
Oh, I think
I have to actually win this battle? Damn it.
Yeah, so they're kind of they made a lot of sense, I guess, back in the day, but nowadays I don't think they're so necessary. I don't know. They're still kind of fun in that retro way. I have no strong opinions one way or the other.
What do you think of, did you have any opinions on Kuja?
He has a nice dragon.
He does have a nice dragon. I guess you haven't really gotten to know him yet.
I haven't really gotten to know him too well yet. But I do want to know more about him, so that's a good sign. I'm not like, oh, screw you, you're boring. So that's the worst thing you can have for a villain.
As for General Beatrix, I feel like just from a character design standpoint and her position in the army, she reminds me of Celeste.
You know what? I was about to say, not just that she reminds me of Celeste, but I noticed her soldiers have outfits very similar to Celeste's, her sprite work. So if you ever want to take a look at that, because Celeste looks very different between like the game itself and Yoshitaka Amano's drawing. But I did notice parallels.
So, yeah, I mean, of course, Final Fantasy IX is one giant reference throughout. I mean, it stands on its own. You can absolutely play this game without having played previous Final Fantasies and enjoy yourself just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's a coincidence that Beatrix very much resembles Celeste.
No, and that's a very interesting point, because Celeste is a very interesting character in my eyes. Like, she's a very young general female in an army dominated by, like, old guys, like old emperors and, you know, Kefka. And you had that really disturbing plot they kind of erased out of the Super Nintendo script about how Gestahl wanted to breed the two of them. It's like, oh, okay, I'm glad you got thrown off a continent.
She also has a cool sword.
She has a really cool sword.
Sorry, I'm looking through. I Googled General Beatrix just to make sure that I was getting the name right. And now I'm being completely distracted by some amazing General Beatrix cosplay.
Oh, I bet there's some good ones out there.
Oh, God, yes. I'm looking at some of it on Pinterest. It's really amazing what people can totally pull off. She's a great character design, though. I love the...
She's a really nice character design. She's very simple but interesting looking. She's not like a... what's the word I'm looking for? Just an overcomplicated mess of buckles and snaps.
Yeah, I like the eye patch.
Exactly. Actually, I love the eye patch.
She reminds me of L Driver from Kill Bill, who is one of the main enemies of the main character in that movie. So, which is pretty amusing. I mean, Final Fantasy IX obviously came out like 3 years before Kill Bill. But yeah, it's funny to me that her name is Beatrix, but she looks like L Driver. But people who've seen that movie will understand what I'm talking about. But in any case, the disc ends with Bermesia destroyed. Kuja gives you... everybody's like kind of messed up and like is right. They're on their knees, and Kuja kind of flounces his hair. Very attractive. Yes. And turns around and walks away in a kind of an equivalent of the Final Fantasy VII Sephiroth walking into the fire. It feels like a callback to that, actually. Yeah. And the dragon's like, I'm a big dragon, and then walks out after him. And you go, well, okay, that's a pretty nasty villain right there.
That's the thing I'm going to have to fight.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, no, it's a solid ending to the first disc.
It definitely makes me interested to fight him, to meet him. Although the one foe I really dreaded fighting through the whole game was Luca Blight.
Well, so you dreaded fighting Luca Blight? Why? Didn't you want to take him out?
Yeah, but I knew he knew his shit, and I'm like, oh God, he's gonna destroy me.
I always anticipate the big fight, going one on one. We're gonna take him out.
I get scared very easily when it comes to bosses. Like, don't hurt me, friends.
So one more thing, did you go up the ladder and run into the super strong dragons?
Let me tell you about those dragons. I did.
Because this is what happens to everybody. You go up the dragon, you get totally messed up by the dragons.
Yeah. Just to kind of lay out the scene, you go to a grotto on your way to Bermesia, and there's a big Leviathan thing that lives there, and unfortunately you have to kill it because it's being controlled by dark magic, and there's a couple of Moogles that are getting married, and the bell falls and traps like the female Moogle's maid underneath it. That was kind of cute. So I free him. They go into the next room, whatever, and that's where you can go up this ladder. But if you go up the ladder, one of the Moogles says, it's dangerous, don't go up there. And I'm like, shut up, what do you know? And you go up there, and you're on this little tiny plateau, and the only enemies living there, or mostly the only enemy living there, is this thing called a Grand Dragon. Which I'm looking at this, and it's like, oh, okay, you're a screen-filling dragon, but I bet I can take you out. I have Freya, and she has Dragon Killer, which is an ability. Nope. He just, like, did a poison claw and, like, just, like, I was gone in one hit. So I said, you know what? Screw you. And what I did was I cheated. I turned on the 999,000 hit. So I did that, and I gained a bunch of levels, and I'm like, yes.
What? What a cheater.
I know, but I wanted to see what would happen. And I killed the dragon, all right? The dragon
cheating
died.
Cheat Nadia here.
I
told you the story about how in college, Emily decided that she was going to get all of my party members up to level 99.
Yes, so, was she on that stupid plateau all day?
Yep, she went to that plateau and she killed dragons until the... And by the time you get to like level 60, there's a point where the dragons don't give that much experience anymore,
of
but she kept
not.
Killing those dragons. I think the thing that's cool is that I think the dragons can use Thundaga on you.
Mm-hmm.
And Thundaga obviously is very impressive at that point in the game, because I don't even think you have Thundara at that point. Do you have Thundara yet?
No, I only just started buying equipment that can let me learn like the level 2 spells.
Yes, so seeing level 3 spells being used is, yes, when you get your shit completely wrecked, pardon my language, against one of those dragons, it's pretty amazing.
Basically, when you're at that level and you're up against a screen-filling enemy, that should be, like, danger signal number one, but then it breaks out Thundaga at that level, and you're like, oh, I probably shouldn't be here right now?
The Moogle tells you!
I know, but I ignored the poor Moogle, I'm sorry.
Don't ignore the Moogle, Nadia.
The Moogle was right, I was wrong.
I should put that on a shirt. Don't ignore the Moogle, Nadia. All right. Anything else that you want to add about this week's Final Fantasy IX report?
I really like Freya. I think she's a really interesting character. And I hear that she kind of gets ignored later in the game, and that makes me sad.
Quinna, great character or best character?
She's pretty great. But I think I like Freya even better.
Who is your party right now?
Right now, I've got... Zidane, Quinna, Vivi, and Freya.
Quinna does love those frogs. I like Vivi. Vivi and Steiner are pretty OP for the most part. Freya, I just like dragoons, and Freya is my favorite dragoon, so I like having her in my party as well.
I find it interesting. This is something I said on either Facebook or Twitter. Her last name is Crescent, which is the surname of Sephiroth's mother.
Oh, yeah, I find that pretty interesting.
That is very interesting, because usually, not always, dragoons are Highwind. That's their surnames. Although, someone pointed out to me, Freya is left-handed, which is another dragoon trait.
Ooh.
So, there you go.
All right, and on that note, check out the website for the written versions of our respective reports. And, of course, keep an eye out next week as we continue on into Disc 2. Of Final Fantasy IX as we continue our Final Fantasy IX reports. Okay, Nadia, as always, we have reader comments that we're going to be reading. And we talked a little bit last week about how Zidane's kind of ugly. You weren't a big fan of the Zidane. And Johnny Boy 407 says, I'll stick up for Zidane a little bit. I like the guy, but he's definitely a different direction for a main character, especially among the PS1 Final Fantasies. Mm-hmm. He's a character that's already achieved self-actualization, or so it seems, when you first meet him. He doesn't have an inner struggle or journey that reflects his external journey. He's along for the ride. He functions more as a side character in the narrative, helping Garnet on her journey to self-reliance, Vivi on his journey to self-confidence. It's not until his own sense of self and identity is shattered that he has a personal journey to complete. What also sets him apart is his whimsical, fun-loving nature and that helpful attitude, a far cry from Cloud and Squall, and I think that's why I like him. He's a new flavor. What do you think, Nadia?
Yeah, I totally see where that's coming from. Cloud, I find people get wrong. Like, I defend him more than some people, because Cloud is, not to get too spoilery, but there is a reason why he comes off as not so much a jerk, but like he's a little cold, but he does warm up as the game goes on, and he discovers more about himself. Squall, I never liked Squall. Zidane, yeah, I totally get where that comment is coming from, because I do think it's different, and I appreciate how he knows what he wants to do in life, and I do know there is a crisis later on in the game. I don't know exactly the nature of that crisis, so don't spoil anything, but that is very interesting, because there are not too many heroes who think they have it all figured out, and they all just get smacked down like and have to rebuild themselves. That is an interesting angle.
One of my favorite movies is Star Trek II, and it was written by a man named Nick Meyer, and he said that his favorite thing to do is to make a hero who is self-confident, swashbuckling, and awesome, like Captain Kirk, look in the mirror and have to admit that they are a fool, that they know nothing. That is
Jon Snow.
That is his favorite thing. You know nothing, Jon Snow. But, I mean, that's one of the major moments in Star Trek II, is in the TV show, Captain Kirk has always been the hero, right? The one-dimensional leading man, the womanizer, who has a girl in every planet, is always killing the monsters, whatever. And at the end of Star Trek II, he faces his own mortality. He made mistakes. Crew members died, including his best friend. And he says, I know nothing. Mm-hmm. I was a fool.
Exactly.
It's one of my absolute favorite moments in Star Trek, to strip away all of the bravado of a hero and have it just laid bare for you is really great. And so in that respect, I think that's actually a cool thing about Zidane as well. Also, I like the point of him being a facilitator, facilitating all of these other stories, because there's so many really interesting, wonderful stories going on, especially with Vivi.
Yeah.
And Quina, I mean, Quina's journey of self-reflection in discovering all of the different wonderful foods to eat.
And how many frogs you can catch.
Oh, many frogs.
It's interesting to look back on the facilitator comment where I am now, because I played Final Fantasy XII, and I thought that very much of Vaughn. He is not the main guy. He is just the guy from which everything else springs from. It's more about, you know, Balthier and Fran and everyone else dealing with their problems, and everyone's like, shut up, Vaughn, you know?
Shut up, Vaughn.
Shut up, Vaughn. Shut up, kid.
All right. We also have an email from Ryan Fichtel. Nadia, as you may recall in a previous episode, we were talking about SNES RPGs from hell. And one of the games that we talked about was Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, the quote-unquote baby Final Fantasy that was made just for us Americans because we didn't know anything. And Ryan writes, I just wanted to write in regard to Final Fantasy Mystic Quest. Now, I fully realize today that this game is a sack of garbage, save a few things such as the incredible soundtrack. However, when I was 12, this was the first major RPG I played, and I absolutely loved it. I was a Sega Genesis owner in the 90s, and so the only time I ever got to play a SNES was at my friend's house. I used to sleep over, and we would play games pretty much all night. When he initially showed me Mystic Quest, I was instantly hooked. It wasn't like any game I had ever played before. I had played Zelda and a little bit of Ultima Exodus on the NES, but I was mostly into Tecmo Super Bowl and Contra. Mystic Quest was so colorful, it popped off the screen. The enemy sprites were huge, and they changed as you progressed through in the fights. The changing of companions that joined you kept things interesting, and the different weapons you could equip that allowed you to accomplish different tasks on the dungeon maps were incredible. The clock could climb certain walls, bombs blowing up walls, and the axe chopping down trees. For someone who had never really sat down and played a JRPG before, this stuff was all amazing. Even the story was pretty crazy for me at that time. This was a game that got my friend and I hooked on RPGs, and I have been playing them ever since. While we quickly moved on to Final Fantasy VI, Chrono Trigger, and for me, the sad set Genesis owner in the era of Squaresoft SNES exclusivity, Shining Force 2, playing these made us realize just how bad Mystic Quest truly was. But for introducing me to the genre that I now love, Mystic Quest will always have a special place in my heart. Yeah, Nadia, is there an RPG you look back on and go, man, that game actually wasn't that good, but I sure loved it back in the day?
I wouldn't say like I look back on it and say, wow, that's bad, but Secret of Mana was the first game that really taught me, hey, you know, games can have really great stories, even though you know now perfectly well that it's a very simple, tropey story, but it is very charming in its own way. So that was I see where he's coming from, where like I could see if that was your first RPG, that would be kind of a mind-blowing experience. Even Final Fantasy IV story, which is very much Star Wars with, you know, Japanese characters, is compelling in its own way, but you look back on it and it's like, oh, okay, well, this is what it is. But when you look at it as a kid, it's really incredible.
If looking back on the games that I used to own as a kid have taught me anything, it's that I had an excellent taste in video games. I don't know why, but it seems like all the games that I owned were pretty much classics. And yeah, I had some bad games. I played Ghostbusters 2, for God's sake.
God.
I played that game into the ground. Also Indiana Jones for the NES. But, you know, when you're a kid, you kind of
stupid game.
Yeah, you kind of play everything. Hindsight, Battletoads, not that great.
Yeah, Battletoads, not very good.
I used to think Final Fantasy VII was the greatest RPG and that it was actually untouchable. And to argue against that was stupid. But then I got a little older and realized that, no, the story wasn't actually that deep. It was interesting. And ambitious, but I needed to stop acting like it was, you know, up there with Shakespeare or something like that. I wasn't the smartest
That was a sign of like being a 90s kid when he thought that like Final Fantasy VII was like Shakespeare.
I don't think I ever used that term, but I do remember thinking anime is the perfect genre. I mean, it's so deep. and so amazing. And how can you possibly argue against it? It's incredible. It's the greatest thing ever made. And if you don't watch anime, you're an idiot. Yes, that was me in high school. I was insufferable. Thank you for asking. All right. Thanks for writing in, Ryan. And as always, you can contribute your own thoughts on everything we talk about. Send us an email at usgamer@usgamer.net or leave a comment on show notes or follow us on the Twitter machine. I'm at @_capot and Nadia is at Nadia Oxford. And of course, Acts of the Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Do me a favor. If you're really enjoying the podcast, please leave a review and rate us. We really appreciate it. It helps our visibility on all of the various places where you can get podcasts if you leave a review. And plus, it warms our heart when you like the podcast. Yes, it makes us feel good to see comments from you, and it makes us want to continue to do this show. We've been doing this for a few years now. It's time consuming, and it can give you a little bit of a boost, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm, as always, on Twitter at @_capedits. I was just saying, Nadia Oxford. Twitter, US Gamer, US Gamernet. Facebook, US Gamernet. And of course, don't forget that we stream every Tuesday and Thursday. US Gamernet, Mike and Katie have continued their quest for the chicken dinner in PUBG. And occasionally I jump in there too. I did an SNES Classic Marathon not too long ago, mm-hmm. which was kind of fun. And if you want to find out when I do these more impromptu streams, you should subscribe. And of course, we have our other podcast, which is the US Gamer Podcast. And last week, let's see, we were talking about loot boxes. We were talking about Katie's first Xbox. I didn't realize that this was a thing for her since she never really had an Xbox. But I guess she's pretty young, so...
Yeah.
She never, and you know, when you're young, you're poor, so it's hard to get a system that you don't necessarily care about.
Absolutely.
And you talked about the EZ8 localization. And
talked about the EZ8 localization and also the Nintendo World Championship.
Oh, yeah, which you went to.
I did, and it was a lot of fun, and I kind of relayed my experiences, not only through my podcast, but through, I wrote a thing for US Gamer itself.
That yes, has you lots did.
Of pictures and videos and stuff to keep your attention.
Yeah, we got a bunch of cool stuff up on the site. Mike did a big history of microtransactions and loot boxes and everything. I wrote a little bit about FIFA and the U.S. national team crashing out. There were the Final Fantasy IX and Secret of Mana reports. And, oh, yeah, we rounded up all of Jeremy Parrish's Metroid mm-hmm. game-by-game reviews. We reviewed every single Metroid game.
We did.
If you want to read about that, if you want to read reviews for Metroid 1, 2, Prime, Prime 2, yes, even Metroid Other M, that is on the site. Okay. We will be back, as always, next Friday. And until then, for Nadia and myself, I've been Cat Bailey. We'll see you again soon. Happy adventuring.